Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect, the time is 1:05. Today is Monday, January 26, 2009. Today we have Representative Wilson, Seaton, Kawasaki, and our new member, Representative Tuck, Olsons, Edgman, and Guttenberg. We do have a quorum present. Also, for the record, Representative Johnson is excused. He's flying around Alaska somewhere right now, but I'm sure he would rather be here. On the agenda today was an overview by TransCanada on their Alaska pipeline project. We were also scheduled to hear an overview by Denali, but they're on the same plane with Representative Johnson, so we'll see what happens, and maybe they can show up here later. I would certainly hope that members of this committee do all they can to meet with the members from TransCanada and Denali Corporation to get up to grade or up to speed on where they're at. A lot of things have been changing. The timelines have changed, and when they're moving forward, folks, and that's a good thing. So get to know these folks. We're going to hold today's hearing too. I asked Tony, when I like to do the hearings, we're gonna do this overview with some slides, and Tony Palmer and Tom Roberts. So ask your questions as we go along here. This was scheduled for a three-hour hearing from 1 to 3, so at least an hour and a half with TransCanada. I think that'll give us plenty of time there, and maybe we'll have some time for some more questions. But what I would like to ask committee members to do is, because this is on their pipeline project and what they're doing on their pipeline, try and hold your questions in on their construction of their pipeline. Obviously, they're talking to a lot of different producers, and who knows what's going to happen on in the future, and that's a lot of that's proprietary information that they're working with anyhow, so you will only be able to discuss that very limited. But try and stay to the subject of their construction of the pipeline, their timeline, what it's going to look like. There's a lot here to talk about. This is a new presentation. It's not the ones that we've seen earlier, so got some good stuff coming. Mr. Palmer, please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tony Palmer. I'm Vice President of Alaska Development for TransCanada. Happy New Year to all, and very pleased to be back in front of this committee. Mr. Chairman, would you like me to proceed with my presentation?
Yeah, Tony, please proceed here, and then like I said, committee members, just raise your hand and we'll call on you and as we go along.
Thank you. This is the same map that you will have seen in the past, but I did want to show some of, I've put some photos in for those of you that have a visual image of a pipeline being the Alaska oil line. Which, of course, has been in service now for some 30 years. I want you to just visualize as we go through here what a gas pipeline is going to look like when it's in service. You can see, really, if you look at the photo on the right, you'll see these small signs here which really illustrate that there is a pipeline there. So if you were to go and dig, you should look for those signs. But the pipeline, of course, will be buried. The top of the pipeline will be 4 feet deep, and you can see that several years after, we've allowed the vegetation to regrow on the project along that right away. This is what you would see in a forest. You'll see other pictures as we go forward.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Guttenberg,
thank you. Just a question on the photograph. The clearing in the background, that looks like about a 30 or 40 foot wide clearing. Is that what you expect on your project, or is it more as compared with what Alyeska was looking at for right-of-way access and clearance?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, you will see that during construction we will have a wider right-of-way. In fact, quite often start with a right-of-way that is something in the order of, I'm going to translate from meters to feet. You quite often start with a right-of-way that would be a few hundred feet, but when you're completed, this right-of-way would be 40 to 50 meters, so something in the order of 120 to 150 feet wide would be the normal right-of-way when you are completed and in operation. You need a much narrower right-of-way post-construction for operation. And this is, the photo on the right, is what you would see for normal enjoyment of the right-of-way for the following 25 to 50 years.
And Tony, now let's just to make sure that we're clear. This is all buried, and so this is what we expect to see along the pipeline. And how would it look where the it follows the corridor of TAPS?
Mr. Chairman, you would see that it would be buried as well. It would be, in certain cases, very close to the TAPS line. We're still specifying the precise route, but you would not see the natural gas pipeline. What you would see is where there is an offtake. Of course, you would come up out of the ground at that point if there was an offtake, and you will see compressor stations, and I will show you a picture of that later, and there will be six compressor stations initially, so one every 120 or so miles. So a very wide gap between compressor stations, and you'll see that would be an industrial site, and I will show you that.
Thank you. And I think that's Representative Johnson trying to come in here online, so welcome, Representative Johnson.
Representative Newman, I'm just going to listen in if I could. I'm out in the wind in Sitka, so I'm just going to listen in and hopefully mute me, and I'm sure you'll want to do that more often than this, but I appreciate it.
You're always welcome, my friend.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Tony.
Okay, I'm going to turn to slide three. Before I speak to precisely where we are on the project and the details on that, which will be the bulk of my presentation, I did want to focus this committee and describe for you what TransCanada feels it takes to make a successful pipeline project. We've been in the business a very long time, and we think we have a good understanding as to what makes a pipeline succeed. And I'll just go through this slide very quickly. You will know full well that natural gas prices are volatile and difficult to forecast. I think the last time I was in front of you, natural gas prices were $10 and $12. I looked this morning and they were $4.50, 6 months later. We have no impact on natural gas prices as a pipeline company. In fact, I don't think you will find anyone that sits in front of you as producers that will tell you that they have influence on natural gas prices. They are set in the marketplace, and they are often influenced significantly by political events, by economic events, and certainly by the price of oil. And we've all seen that fluctuate. So that's something that I'm not here in front of you to talk about, is the variability of natural gas prices. But we all need to be aware of that. Secondly, competitors in the marketplace for natural gas in North America are there. They are producing lower 48 gas conventional gas. WCSB is just Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin. LNG, shale, and coal bed methane, they will all compete for market share. Once again, not something we can control and not something that we are focused on as we advance this project. We will be cognizant of that. That is important that we're aware of that. However, project supporters, sponsors as well as supporters like yourselves, governments, regulatory agencies, and other parties, in our view, to be successful, must focus on a number of things, cost and schedule. We've described for you the commercial terms, did that for you throughout 2008, so I won't repeat that with you today. Commercial regulatory risk management, schedule and cost control. On existing pipelines in North America, customers switch on a penny difference. That happens every day. So if they want to decide whose pipeline they ship gas on, if you are a penny more than your neighbor going to the same markets, you lose the business. And for new projects, they certainly swing on several pennies. So it is critical that we focus on cost. And I gave a presentation to RDC a couple of months ago identifying that if the capital cost changes by $1 billion, that changes the pipeline toll by 10 cents per MMBTU. 10 cents per MMBTU is $160 million a year in tolls. That share comes out of the producer's hide and governments. That's where you get your value. And by the way, $160 million for a 25-year contract is $4 billion in future dollars. So that tells you how critical costs are for this project. And I'll just focus on the last bullet for a second. Our total estimate that we prepared in late 2007, as we made our AG application, had tolls of $2.76 in 2018 to the Alberta Hub. You've seen that. We'll be updating that as we prepare for the open season a year from now, and we feel it's critically important to keep those tolls under $3.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Could you, I just was really captured on that 276, and especially that comment about a difference of 10 cents having an effect of $160 million per year. When you're practicing your risk management or you're weighing out risk management, what are you dealing? How are you dealing with cost overruns? How do you figure that into that?
So, Mr. Chairman, we have a couple of proposals that we have in front of. We put in front of the committees last year, in front of the legislature. Our proposal is that TransCanada would bear some of that risk. We have a proposal where we would take a reduction in our rate of return up to a total of 2% of our rate of return. 200 basis points. That's our proposal. Secondly, we have a proposal that, if acceptable to the government of the United States, that the loan guarantee structure would be adapted so that the U.S. government would bear some of the capital cost overrun risk in certain circumstances. And finally, some of the risk would reside with customers, shippers.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tony, you mentioned that maybe TransCanada is not focused on the overall big picture of the economics. I'm focused on it. It's on the news every day. I just like to hear just sort of and I know this may be not the discussion or forum for discussion, but you mentioned that when we were predicting the cost of gas, it was at $10 to $12 in MMBTU, and now it's $4. I mean, that's got to have an impact in the overall big picture, and I just kind of want to hear an opinion or a sentiment about that and where we're at today with the world economic situation.
Sure. Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, and I hope I was clear. We are cognizant of what's happening in the world, both with competitors for this project as well as the price of natural gas and the price of oil and the world financial situation. However, our focus will be on cost and schedule for this project. That's how we think we will succeed. But let me come to your question specifically. I will tell you frankly that when prices were $10 and $12 last year, I personally did not think that was sustainable. I personally do not think that $4.50 is sustainable either going forward. This project will be in service in the best case in 9.5 years from now, and then we'll be in service for 25 or 50 years thereafter. So it is truly what will the price of natural gas be out in that time frame, which is critical. I think that customers, as well as other parties, will always look at the current price of natural gas. It's normal to do so. And in fact, very experienced forecasters in our business, if you examine their forecasts, they always seem to be centered around the current price. So when gas prices are $10, a lot of people will tend to focus that they forecast that they will go up from there. When they're at $4, they often tend to forecast they will go up from there. That's not unusual. I think I've said before that if parties believe that natural gas prices are going to continue to fall down to $2, well, this is clearly not a viable project. You can see that we've got a total estimate of more than $2. And there is a reason why this project did not go forward for many decades, and that was the low price of gas. However, most parties continue to project that gas prices will rise from here. No one knows at what point when they will turn. But on a sustained basis, most forecasts that I have seen are higher than today's prices. And if we can keep the tolls under $3, and I will tell you that in a pipeline project, schedule often drives cost. So if there's a delay, like you've seen in McKenzie, you generally see a cost increase on a project like this. That is what drives costs. Not the only thing, but that's a very significant matter. So we will look to regulatory agencies and governments, as we will, to maintain that schedule. If you see a gas price on a sustained basis of $6 or $7, which most parties have a forecast of that, then if we can keep the tolls under $3, there remains a substantial margin for producers and for governments. And that's what we will be focused on. $6 to $7 gas price probably means an oil price somewhere in the order of $40 to $60, which I think if you would ask most forecasters beyond this year, not in the short run, but beyond this year, most parties believe that that is a sustainable oil price. Certainly, we have seen a reaction already in the marketplace to these low prices. You're seeing a reduction in gas drilling in the lower 48 and Canada. You're seeing a reduction in a number of projects, and you're certainly, unfortunately, in our industry starting to see layoffs in the exploration and production business. So we take the long view. Certainly, the price of natural gas has not affected our work on this project, and you'll see from my schedule that we have not altered our proposal in any way as a result of that.
And I just want to remind the committee members, too, we will, I'm sure I speak for my co-chair, be taking some very in-depth looks at price forecasting, how that's done,
okay.
A lot of different things, but let's look at TransCanada's pipeline proposal. Did you have another question, follow-up on that?
Yeah, just to clarify then, for the short term, the short-term economics, the next 2 years, you're focused on the 10-year getting the project in the ground, and that's, I mean, when we're talking commercial terms, you know, how do you expect to get shippers and, you know, when you're dealing with commercial terms with the producers right now, and that's a question I'll follow up later in the presentation, but how far, you know, what's the short-term perspective on that particular aspect, getting commercial terms defined in your company's overall building of the pipeline?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, the potential customers on this project are very sophisticated parties who we believe also take the long view. But I would not want to represent to you that parties will not look at the price of gas at the time where they'll be asked to commit during the open season, which is 18 months from now. They will examine that. I think that's fair to say. But they will also look forward at the future forecast. I think they will do that. The commercial terms that we have presented to this committee, as well as to the legislature in general, are open and transparent. We're in a very unique situation. I think I described last year that we're going into a discussion with potential customers when we've already identified what our commercial terms are. That's highly unusual. So those commercial terms are public. You have seen them. We think they're competitive. And if we're able to keep the capital cost low, we propose to keep those commercial terms as is. And you could see that if we're able to keep our capital costs down, we will be able to keep the cost of this project and the tolls under $3. And we think that makes it competitive. With current natural gas prices this morning, you would still have a positive netback for this project if it was in service and if we had built it for $2.76. I will grant you the netback would be low, but it is positive. And that is critical, that even in a time of stress, you still have a positive netback. In a time of where gas prices are higher, then you have a much larger share for producers and governments to split.
I think a way to kind of bring that all together is look at what's happened in the last year. This is a 25-year project, so who knows. Representative Seaton and then Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Palmer. I'm curious, you know, we have the economic structure, the bails out, inflation, question deflation, all those. And I'm wanting to ask not what your forecast is for inflation or deflation, but structurally how that works into the tariff. And I guess what I'm asking is, let's say we print a lot of money and gas prices on inflation double. That would go to the producers. But your structure on the tariff is a long-term tariff structure. So is that basically solely dependent on the construction costs, and so no matter what happens in the future, as far as inflation pressures, the tariff is fixed for a long period of time. That's my assumption. I'm trying to find out if that's correct.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the proposal that we have is based on a capital cost estimate, which we prepared in 2007. It's also prepared based on an inflation factor that was provided to us by the state of Alaska, and there were government forecasts. And those inflation factors really principally affect the toll as you go through the construction phase. So now through the next 9.5 years, that's when the money would be spent, and the bulk of the inflationary impact on the tolls occurs during that phase. Beyond that phase, the only real inflationary factor is on operating costs, which is a really small component of the ultimate cost, or the ultimate tolls. The bulk of the toll is driven off capital costs, just as you described. So if you have relatively lower inflation during the course of the next decade, that's a very good thing. You get lower tolls. And then if beyond that you have higher gas prices, you have the best of both worlds. You build in a low-cost environment, and you get to flow gas in a high-cost environment. What you try to avoid is building in a high cost and then having to flow gas for 50 years in a low cost. That's the worst of all worlds. And usually over time, you hope for some balance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Olson.
Welcome back to General Mr. Palmer.
Thank you, Representative Olson.
During the AGIER process, the number that TransCanada was using as an estimate for the construction, I believe, was $28
billion. $26 billion, as I recall, in,
and change.
Representative Olson.
The administration in November started using $40 billion. It's my understanding the price of steel and the price of labor has dropped. I think with the price of steel has dropped significantly. With labor, I have no idea how much has dropped. But if that's the case, where has the estimated $12 billion increase come from? And if that's, if $40 billion is not a correct estimate, what do you currently see the estimate for the gas line as being?
Representative Olson, through the chair, TransCanada's forecast of capital costs remain at the $26 billion. The last time we completed this was in the summer fall of 2007 for our AGIA application. We have not completed an update of that cost estimate since that point. We will do so over the course of the next 12 months as we go forward for our open season. You'll see that shortly on a schedule that I think you're quite familiar with. We will be completing a new cost estimate over the course of the next 12 months. We will at that point be looking at the changes up and down in a number of costs, and hope that we are able to hold it at the $26 billion. So I won't speak to any other estimate other than TransCanada's. It is true that so far this year, we have seen steel prices fall. However, the price of rolled pipe has not fallen much at this point, and so the margins for steel producers, pipe producers, are better. And I would suggest to you that's at least partially because there are a great number of pipeline projects underway in North America. And as those are completed over the course of the next 12 or 18 months, if steel prices stay down, I would expect you would also see the prices of rolled pipe fall as well. So we will be examining all of that as we go forward. And in 12 months' time, I will have an updated number for you, and it will be public because we'll be putting that in our open season proposal in the spring of next year.
Hello. So if we're still using $26 billion for your estimate, why have you asked Congress for an increase in the loan guarantees?
Representative Olson, through the chair, in fact, we have not asked Congress for an increase in the loan guarantees. You may be referring to a question that was posed to our CEO during the course of year-end interviews, and he was asked, well, what support could the government of the United States provide for this project? In that context, he said, through the course of 2004 through 2008, the costs of oil and gas projects had increased more than consumer price indexes. And As you're probably aware, the U.S. government loan guarantee is $18 billion plus CPI, Consumer Price Index. And he suggested at that time that the government of the United States may wish to consider, we had not requested, nor have we requested since, they may wish to consider applying an oil and gas inflator rather than a consumer price inflator. So he did not suggest that the $18 billion should increase, nor has TransCanada suggested that, nor have we asked Congress for it. That's clearly in their hands. And as we go through this year with a new administration in place and a new Congress in place, we'll consider what we do. But I want to be clear, we have not requested that of the Congress, nor have we requested that of the new administration.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tony, I kind of want to piggyback on to this just a little bit here. Because the cost of steel fluctuates and the rolled pipe, if there are cost overruns, where I don't know whether labor will be the same or not, those costs, if we have cost overruns, how does that affect the tariff?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, TransCanada's proposal that we put forward under AGEA would have the following occur if we had a capital cost overrun. TransCanada would get a lower rate of return. That's the first component. If the government of the United States were to approve the proposal we put in front of you under AGEA, which we would have to put forward to them, we had a proposal that capital cost overruns, if they occur, would be funded through the U.S. government loan guarantee. We don't know whether or not the U.S. Congress and the administration will support that. But if they did, then those costs would be separated and collected in a surcharge when gas prices were good. If they do not accept it, then there would be a change in our rate of return. That will always take place, and the remainder would increase the toll to customers.
That certainly seems like a question that we may want to look into a little more in depth there, because that's a big question there.
And Mr. Chairman, that is something that we put forward as a concept in front of the legislature last year, as an idea we have as to how the government of the United States could share in the risk of the project. There at the moment is no, there are no regulations for the loan guarantee. There's the legislation, but there are no regulations. And that's something that TransCanada indicated that we are supportive of, that we would inquire whether or not Congress and the new administration would be supportive of that. Clearly, it would mitigate risk for customers if they were supportive.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Follow-up?
A little bit of follow-up. I think we do need to talk about this a little bit more, but not today, or you know, maybe not as we go through here. You know.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Just for a little clarification, Mr. Chairman, on the loan guarantee portion, as I recall, the reason for asking that the loan guarantee be applied is because then there is security and it can lower the interest rate on the money that is borrowed for cost overruns. Am I remembering that correctly, or can you fill me in on that again?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, and I too will go from memory, although I'm quite familiar with this, is the concept was probably threefold. One is it would, as you described, it would lower the cost for customers because you would have debt 100% financing for overruns rather than debt and equity. That's clearly a benefit for customers. Because the cost of debt is lower than the cost of equity. Secondly, there would be an incentive that TransCanada would not receive a dime extra as a result of a cost overrun. You've heard some parties say accusingly to TransCanada, we would be not motivated to control costs. Hogwash, I say, but looking at this specifically would clearly mean that we would make not one extra penny as a result of a cost overrun, because it would be 100% financed with debt, not with equity. And thirdly, it would be a structure that would allow the government of the United States to bear some of the risk of recovery. In our proposal, is it would be recovered in a surcharge if gas prices were higher rather than lower.
Okay.
Thank you. And to page four.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think I've addressed a lot of this, is we need, like any commercial party, need the support of governments and communities. And I've listed them here. And, of course, we need commercial contracts with shippers. And I'll just, on this picture on the right, if you look at the break in the trees here, you'll see where the right-of-way of the pipeline is. This is revegetated. You can see that's the pipeline route right there. And you see the break in the trees. This is the prairies. And you'll see that it's very difficult. If you did not know that there was a pipeline right away, it would be hard to see it.
For the record, I did ask Mr. Palmer if hunters would have access up and down that right away, and he told me, unfortunately, no. So.
And in fact, I will show you this same picture here coming up on the next page. We'll show you what it will look like under construction. I'll flip back and forth for you here. And I think the final element for success in a project of this nature is you need to have measured and focused project planning, structure, and performance, and you need a proven project developer. We have a 50-year track record of success in multi-jurisdictional pipeline projects. I would tell you that we believe that no other corporation has our track record, and I'd be pleased to match our track record against any of our competitors in the industry. We currently have a $12 billion oil pipeline under construction to move more than a million barrels of oil from Western Canada down to Illinois, Cushing, Oklahoma, and ultimately to Houston. The first phase of that will be complete in a year, and the remainder by 2012. And if you look at the picture on the bottom here, you will see it's the same location. You'll see the pipeline actually strung here beside the trench. The trench is on the left. And a couple of days later, the pipeline will be laid in that trench and buried. And in fact, I'll just take you back to the previous slide so you can see what it looks like when complete and revegetated. And there, of course, is during construction.
And Mr. Palmer, could you go a little bit on the construction of this pipeline? Size of the pipe, the wall width, pressures that it goes under, how it's constructed, the procedures that go through to build this pipeline quickly?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. TransCanada's proposal is a 48-inch diameter pipeline. It has just over 1-inch wall thickness, so very thick steel. It's X80, and X80 is a pressure for a pipeline that will withstand 80,000 pounds per square inch. Not that you will run it at that, but that's ultimately what it would withstand. The pipeline would be 2,500 pounds of pressure in Alaska, 2,600 in Canada. That's our current proposal for the project. It would be, you'll see in my schedule upcoming, the actual logistics and stringing of the pipe along the right-of-way would occur in 1 year, and then the actual construction would occur for 2 years following. So what you see on this slide here in front of you, you would only see the pipeline like that for a period of 6 to 12 months in each location. And then, of course, it's buried and looks much like what we showed you on the earlier slide once it's been revegetated. So the physical construction in a particular neighborhood is generally 6 to 12 months. Prior to that, you have a haul road and you have a stringing of the pipe along the right-of-way so that you can weld it together and then lower it in.
And I don't want to dwell on that greatly, but discussions that we had on social pressures and what happened during the Trans-Alaska pipeline, and Representative Gutenberg was there, he worked on them, you know, with the flow of money, influx, people into communities, how communities dealt with that. But you're going to, because you're only going to be in one area for about a year, staging areas will be proposed along the routes. You don't have large staging areas. Could you kind of briefly discuss how you plan to deal with that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I will briefly address that. We would expect that we would have camps, enclosed camps, that where the staff for the construction would be located. There will be several thousand workers on this project over the course of that two-year time frame, a more modest amount in the what I would call the pre-construction phase, and certainly a very small number of people at the present time and certainly post-construction. But you would have in the order of 6,000 to 8,000 people in Alaska on the construction teams over the course of 2 years. And they will be moving, of course. They will be located in different spreads. And could one expect that there will be some socioeconomic impacts? Yes, you could. This is an industrial development. There will be some impacts. I wouldn't profess to you that there would be none. However, we are well experienced in managing that, and we will certainly work with the appropriate agencies, both state and federal, to manage those to the best of everyone's ability. But I do not want to pretend to you that there will be no socioeconomic impact. The flip side, of course, is once completed, there will be a massive financial benefit as well as access to gas off and on for Alaskans. That's the trade-off that everyone needs to make as they look at any industrial development. Natural gas pipelines are relatively benign. However, they are industrial development.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tony, I'm envisioning these staging areas that maybe the staging area itself is like in the middle of so many miles. How many miles are we talking about in between stage areas?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I won't give you a specific answer because that's in development. So that's not something that we have assessed completely at this point. But you have a 750-mile pipeline, basically, from Prudhoe Bay to the border, or 750 miles to Valdez, depending on which way the customers align for this project. So approximately 750 miles. You would expect that you would have several spreads, pipeline jargon for groups of workers, that would be located along that right-of-way. Some would be working in a particular location in the winter. Some would be working in a different location in the summer, depending on the terrain and the ecological and environmental concerns. So you would expect that there would be 4 to 6 locations where people would be, and certainly you'd be stringing pipe out that year before. You'd be stringing pipe out all along the right-of-way in central locations, but you want to have it accessible so that you're not hauling it for hundreds of miles. And in terms of compressor stations, if we have 6, which is what we would contemplate for a pipeline going on the way to the lower 48 through Alberta, you would have 6 compressor stations in a 750-mile distance, so that's about each 120 miles. So that would also be an industrial site, and I will show you a picture of that as I go forward in this presentation.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Kosaki.
Thank you. Mr. Palmer, we breezed over slide 4, but the big part, I think one of the big underpinnings of elements of a successful project has to be the commercial contracts, commercial terms. I was wondering if you could tell me how far you've gotten or how the discussions are going with potential shippers at this point in time, like 18 months out to a open season.
And if we could just kind of do that briefly, Tony, I think that it's important, but we're going to be getting into that in a lot more depth.
We will.
Okay. Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, I will speak to that directly and with some care, as you understand. I've been in this business now for almost 25 years, and discussions with potential customers are confidential between the pipeline company and their potential customers until you've struck a deal. But I can share with you that we have had discussions with potential customers that want delivery within Alaska, that want delivery on the way to the lower 48 through Alberta, and that want delivery to Asia. So I won't identify those potential customers to you, and I certainly can't speak to the contents of those discussions because they are confidential and they must remain confidential or we will not succeed in securing them. That is the way we conduct our business everywhere on every project, and you would normally see the results of those negotiations at the end of an open season. Potentially it could occur before, but at the end of an open season, at that point you would know who the potential customers are and what their volumes are. But that is proprietary to those parties, and we will keep that confidential for them.
Good enough.
Mr. Palmer, could you, since we're talking about camps and how they work and the construction of the pipeline a little bit on through the slides here, we all have constituents who own small construction companies. I think that's the heart of Alaska. What are you doing to ensure that they all get a piece of the pie? You know, there's maybe 2 or 3 companies large enough in Alaska.
that can do a project like this. But if some of these smaller companies can join forces, or what are we doing to make sure that all Alaska construction companies have an opportunity to participate in this?
Mr. Chairman, you'll see later on in my slide presentation some of the contractors that have currently benefited from the project to this date, and certainly as we go forward into the construction phase and so on, we will be structuring the contracts in such a fashion that there will, of course, be a general contractor that may or may not be a party as you described, but there, of course, will be subcontracting opportunities which we will be enforcing as we go forward to allow parties to have structures and opportunities. We're committed to that. We're committed to that on all of our projects.
Thank you.
On slide six, this is a slide that many of you would be familiar with from last summer. The only comment I would point you to is the footnote at the bottom, is that when we were last in front of you last August, we had assumed that this schedule was driven off an August issuance of the license. The actual issuance, of course, was December the 5th in Fairbanks. But I can tell you that TransCanada continues to target this exact schedule, and at the present time I have seen nothing that would push us off that schedule. But you do need to understand that we got the license 4 months after we had projected, but we continue to target concluding our open season in 18 months time from now. So the end of July 2010 is our target to have results, so that, for example, to respond to Representative Kawasaki's question, at that point we would know who the potential customers are, have they committed their gas, and for what volumes.
And Mr. Palmer, last year you testified that if you did not receive this license by the end of July, especially before the end of the summer working season, that this could be delayed up to a year. What's changed to make it so that you can still meet your completed date at the same time?
Mr. Chairman, you note that I was careful to say our target date is July of 2010, and TransCanada advanced the project after the approval came from the legislature in early August. We advanced the project starting in August, and I will show you that by doing aerial photography with monies of TransCanada's that will not be reimbursed under AGEA, because no reimbursement will come for any monies we expended prior to December the 5th. So we did certain things on our own dime, as it were, in advance of the license issuance to try to maintain that schedule. And we think that that will be successful in allowing us to achieve this target.
Thank you. Page 7.
So, to go clearly to address what we intend to be doing over the course of the next 18 months and what we've done to date, our key objectives: develop a Class 4 cost estimate, that's an engineering terminology which I described to you last year, updated cost estimate, higher quality, support that open season, identify the pipeline routing within a corridor, to be more specific, to be able to be responsive to some of the questions you've had, do the preliminary environmental work to prepare for pre-filing, and of course to conduct a successful open season, get customers, have commercial terms, all of those things. So those are our objectives, and I'll now walk you through what we have done in specific areas and what we plan to do through Q1 and Q2 of this year.
Okay, Tony?
Yes.
On a Class 4 construction project, Class 4, I understand, is that's about 20 to 25% complete. How complete of a proposal is that?
Mr. Chairman.
It's 1 through 5, right?
Mr. Chairman, the standard in the engineering groups, which I'm not one of, but let me try to be responsive to you, is that at this phase in an open season, you would have a Class 4 estimate. So what we provided in the AGEA application was a Class 5 estimate. What you would have at the stage where you conclude your regulatory approvals, so at the end of 2014, if we go to our schedule here, we would have a Class 3 cost estimate. Okay, your actual, I'm wrong there. I think you'd have a Class 3 estimate at the time you make your FERC filing. Your Class 1 estimate only occurs when you're ready to go in service. You've completed the project. So it is a standard that is used in the pipeline industry, used in the engineering industry, and it's a standard that allows you to have a high-quality estimate at certain stages of a project, because we all know that a great deal of money can be spent early in a project when you don't know if you have customers and you don't know if you have regulatory approvals. These stages are set to allow you to achieve these goals.
That's the only reason I brought that up, Tony, was I believe Denali wanted to have a Class 2 proposal at that time for open season. That's why I brought up. We can ask them about that. And I just wanted to make sure committee members knew what they are, bring that to their attention, and kind of look at those details and what's...
Mr. Chairman, I certainly won't speak to what Denali would be preparing. I can just tell you that what TransCanada's standard is, and yep, the standard in the industry, is to have a Class 4 estimate at this stage for open season and a Class 3 estimate as you go to FERC.
That's what you said. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it's really as you go through each phase that goes from Class 5 to Class 4 to Class 3.
Yes. Okay. Yes, exactly right, Representative Wilson, through the chair, is that you gradually increase the accuracy as you go forward. And if you just look at my schedule here, I'll just point you to something that people need to be well aware of, is any cost estimate that is prepared today, of course, cannot be completely accurate on a number of matters, because we are 5 years in advance of ordering steel. We are 5 years in advance of making contracts with contractors and with labor. No one, no matter how much money they spend today, can get an accurate forecast to the penny on those items without pre-committing. And by the way, if you pre-commit for steel today, you pay. Because we are processing and building a number of very large pipelines, and if you pre-order pipe, you prepay. They won't give you 2 or 5 years of mill space without making a very large payment. So I would suggest to you that TransCanada has been very focused on spending money on things that will improve the accuracy. And if you examine what's happened with steel prices and labor prices over the last 5 years, I think you would suggest that you should be cautious as to how much money you spend 5 years in advance. Because will that money show up in the toll? You bet it will.
We're on page 8.
We're on page 8. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is our slide on engineering. The left-hand side identifies what we've completed from August through today, and the right-hand side looks to what we propose to complete in the next two quarters. On the left-hand side, I'll just go very quickly because I've spoken to the chairman about we have done the aerial photography, we have our plans, logistics, we've commenced terrain mapping. We've completed 360-degree video in Canada. The reason we've done that in Canada is we know the specific route. In Alaska, we're still defining that. And we've collected frost heave research. On the right-hand side, you can see that by mid-year, we expect to complete that terrain mapping, do the winter geotechnical field program in Alaska, continue route reconnaissance and corridor selection, and begin the engineering pre-feed for the GTP. And just before the question comes, I want to highlight what those folks are doing in the picture on the right-hand side. Those are the boreholes that we'd be completing for the winter geotechnical program this year. So you can see it's a two-man crew with a very small drill. They're out there taking borehole samples so that we have a good understanding of the soil. We have all that information in Canada. We need to obtain that for Alaska.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tony, could you tell me what 360 video, what that term of art means?
I will, Representative Seaton, through the chair, I will try, because I have seen that, but it's I'll certainly do that in layman's terms. That's all I'm qualified to respond to. They put a camera on the bottom of a helicopter, and that camera can go 360 degrees, and so they shoot all the way along the right-of-way, and in fact, you can play it on your computer. I could do that at some point if you wish, because we have that in Canada. You can do that on the computer, and you can actually stop the video in a particular location and look 360 degrees around that particular location. It's very helpful for engineers that are trying to design to understand the elevation without going out again to look at what they're designing. So very, very helpful piece of video to allow them to know the exact terrain, elevation, and what structures are around that particular location. They use that to help them in design.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The last bullet here on the left, where it's talking about the frost caves, and you've got the data now. And if I understand right, it's going to be underground, but because of the permafrost, there's going to be some movement. And so what have you come up with in ways to, I mean, do you anchor it down, or what happens?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, once again, I'll try to give you the layman's response. We have PhDs in engineering, of course, that study this and have studied this for many decades. TransCanada's proposal, I think the proposals of all proponents, would have a chilled natural gas system. So we would keep the natural gas near the freezing point to minimize the potential movement as a result of permafrost. That's the first action that people will be taking, is you will be chilling the natural gas, and so it's not running hot like the oil line is. Gas normally runs at a lower temperature than oil, but we will be chilling it in addition to that. And secondly, you'll be sitting it in a bed of gravel. That will also mitigate, but I'm certainly not qualified to give you an exact, precise detail what we will be doing, but I can assure you that we have looked at this for a very long period of time, and we'll continue to analyze it before we get to construction.
Thank you.
See, Ms. Palmer, just because it says here on page 8, begin engineering for pre-feed and GTP, just for folks who haven't been doing this for 2 or 4 years, some of the acronyms, could go ahead and explain them as we go through here just to make sure people understand what's going on, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will do that. The GTP is the gas treatment plant at Prudhoe Bay, where you're going to be removing the carbon dioxide and other impurities to be able to make it pipeline quality to enter the pipeline. And the pre-feed is front-end engineering and design. So it's the preliminary work on the gas treatment plant. We would be letting that contract before the end of Q2 of this year.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tony, the GTP, as I remember previously, the scenario that was preferred was for producers to own the GTP. Is that still in a negotiation stage, or does this pre-engineering mean that the project is going to own the GTP?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, clearly it remains TransCanada's wish that producers, for example, would be the owner of that gas treatment plant. However, we have an obligation to meet a time frame for the open season, and since we do not have an arrangement with producers for them to take that over at this point, we must advance the project, and we will continue to advance the project to try to maintain the schedule that I described to you. In the event that we were successful earlier than the open season in making arrangement with other parties to take that over, then we would transition. But this work is intended to allow us to maintain that schedule.
Just to follow up on that, and it seems like things were moving here. I'm trying to make sure we schedule our time appropriately, but it seems like we'll have time to answer. But with the gas treatment plant in projects, it's like, I mean, that's a pretty expensive proposition to build that. How does that affect the open season, the bidding, the tariffs? Is that all part of the big picture in the construction of this?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it is. Yes, it is. The numbers that I described to Representative Olson earlier, the $26 billion, does include the gas treatment plant. And once again, going from memory, about $6 billion of that $26 billion is for the gas treatment plant. So it is a massive plant to be built up at Prudhoe Bay. We have assumed, because TransCanada, of course, has no ownership of the existing facilities at Prudhoe Bay, we've assumed that that is a standalone facility. We do believe that there's potential for some synergies in the event that the current owners of the existing facilities at Prudhoe Bay, if they were to build and own it, they may be able to do it cheaper by using common facilities. That's not something that we could do as a third party. That's why part of the reason why our proposal was that gas treatment plant would be owned by third parties, by those producers, for example, but that's something that they will have to speak to. It is our plan to construct that on the same schedule, similar schedule to what we would be doing for the gas pipeline. You know that that would involve some sea lifts, and we're still examining whether or not that's a two-year sea lift or a three-year sea lift.
Thank you. So I guess, and to summarize that, it's safe to say that TransCanada is prepared to go forward with anything that they need to do to get a gas pipeline and gas flowing as soon as it hits the top of that wellhead.
Mr. Chairman, yes. We clearly believe that our particular skill set is focused on the gas pipeline, but in the we have owned very large gas plants before, and in the event that we have to again, we will do so.
Thank you. Page 9.
Slide 9. On the environmental side, established GIS, that's Global Information System, needs to support environmental planning and permitting. We've completed the environmental preliminary constraints report. We've got the initial route update completed in Canada. And on the right-hand side, you could say we would complete that environmental needs. We would commence development of the RFP. RFP is a request for proposals for the environmental contractor, and we would issue that in Q3 of this year. And I would just highlight for you, here's a river crossing. You can see this river crossing is an open cut. You can see that during construction, you've got a lot of development on either side of the river, a little bit in the river as well. And on the right-hand side, you will see what it looks like a couple of years later after you've revegetated. And you can see that, once again, you see the cut line through the forest and, of course, reclamation in the river. And, in fact, we had a number of parties down from Yukon a couple of years ago examining an open cut as we were crossing a river, and they noted clearly that you see fish swimming on one side of the cut and you see fish swimming on the other side of the cut. We, as well as other pipeline contractors, are very familiar with constructing in that terrain, and I want you to know that we will be careful as we go through Alaska. There will some crossings will be drilled through directional drilling, and some crossings will be open cut, because in certain cases it is either not possible or economic to do drilling. In other cases, that is the best alternative.
Mr. Palmer, on your when you do your request for proposals that you want in the third quarter of 2009 for an environmental contractor, talk to us about how you're trying to work with Alaskan companies, particularly in the Alaska side of this pipeline. You are partnered with the state on this. The state will be putting $500 million towards some of your expenses. I don't know if, there is a requirement in Alaska statute for a 7% preference. Does any of that all come into there? I want to make sure we have Alaskans on this project.
Mr. Chairman, you'll see in an upcoming slide that the current contractor we have for the current stage of the project is an Alaska Anchorage-based contractor. They successfully bid for the work, and you'll see them show up here shortly. And we would expect Alaskans to also be competitive as we go through into Q3 of this year for the longer term.
Thank you.
Next slide, on slide 10, you'll see where we are on the regulatory permitting side. Preliminary environmental permitting strategy. Need to establish your strategy for both Alaska and Canada. We have done that. We have submitted applications to support the winter geotechnical work, which I showed you earlier, those two guys with the drill, to all of these agencies. And on the right-hand side, you will see that in Q1, Q2, we will complete the permitting for the winter geotechnical field program. We're very close on that front. We'll continue discussions with FERC, and we'll commence discussions with individual agencies to update the needs. And on the next page, I wanted to highlight for you the multi-agency meetings that we have already kicked off this month. January 5th, we were in D.C. to see FERC, and on the 6th, we saw other U.S. federal agencies. You'll see them listed here. I won't take them through you through them in detail. And then on the 14th and 15th, I was in Anchorage and Fairbanks, where we met with a number of state and federal agencies as well. So we've had the kickoffs in D.C. and in Alaska.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Goodberg.
The governor recently, Mr. Palmer, the governor recently appointed Mark Meyer, the GIA coordinator. Have you felt that position has been missing in your coordination within these agencies?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, to date, we have managed to move the project forward within the state without having that coordinator, but we're very pleased to see that position filled as we continue to ramp up work. So we look forward to working with Mr. Myers in his new role and look forward to having that coordinator as we ramp up the project. But I will tell you, to date, that has not affected our schedule.
And you haven't met with him yet?
I have not. Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I have not met with him since his appointment. No, that's accurate.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Palmer, I had a question going from memory about the when FERC was here and they were talking about pre-applications or something, and that they were encouraging early application. And I'm looking back here on that page 6 on the pre-filing is showing as 2011. Can you update me on those? I just don't recall what those terminologies were for the early application versus pre-filing.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, yes. I recall as well that FERC was, I think, requesting that TransCanada pre-file earlier than we have on this schedule. And I will tell you that in the discussions we had earlier this month, they continue to wish that TransCanada would pre-file. And TransCanada has had discussions with them, continues to have discussions with them, to see if we are able to meet their objectives and ours as well, and in the event, by an earlier pre-filing, rather than the schedule that we have here. We've committed that we will do so by a date certain under AGEA, which we have as 2011. Our focus, as I've described to you, and you'll probably hear it a bit like a broken record, is on cost and schedule. And cost and schedule is something that, at this stage, we have some control over. Once you've made a pre-filing, some of that control shifts to FERC. And so TransCanada will continue to have discussions with FERC as to whether or not we can create a structure that will work for both of us, that will meet the objectives of both of us. And I would just tell you that we continue to be in discussions with them and hope that we can meet their requirements as well as ours as we go forward. And that could mean that we would pre-file earlier, but I'm not here to tell you that we're ready to change it at this point. We continue to be in discussions with FERC and hope that we can come up with a solution that works for both parties.
Mr. Palmer, can you kind of relate to us, if it's not confidential, what some of those elements are that would be basically transfer of control from the project to FERC if you do the pre-filing?
excuse me, Representative Seaton, through the chair. The stakeholder engagement with individual stakeholders in the project is something that, at the moment, TransCanada is doing directly with potential stakeholders. Once FERC is involved, once you have pre-filed, that would normally be something that FERC would have a greater involvement with. Once you have pre-filed, FERC would normally retain a third-party contractor, which the applicant, TransCanada, would pay for. Those are matters that would be discussed with FERC. They would coordinate federal agencies. They would be the lead agencies that would coordinate them, and how that would relate to the Office of the Federal Coordinator. Those things would all be worked out. So there are a number of matters that we are certainly open to discuss with FERC, and we hope that over the course of the next month or two, we can reach a solution that will work for them and that will work for TransCanada. Certainly, the discussions we've had to date have been positive, and I remain optimistic that we will be successful, but I can't promise until, of course, we've completed those discussions.
One more follow-up. Thank you. So at this point in time, the responsibility of the federal coordinator and FERC, those aren't really resolved, at least in your mind, they're not resolved? Is that what I'm, one of the things I'm hearing?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I don't want to imply that. I would say that we have met with both agencies. You can see I've described it here. We've met with both agencies. They should better speak themselves to how they would coordinate between the two entities as once we have pre-filed. At the moment, FERC's role is less specific than it would be after we have pre-filed. And so I don't want to speak for the Office of the Federal Commissioner. I don't want to speak for FERC as to how they would be responsible for coordinating. They should better speak to that. To date, that has not affected our schedule. There has been no implications, negative implications for our schedule, and we're very pleased with the relations we have with both entities and look forward to continuing fruitful discussions with them to ensure that FERC is satisfied with where we are and that TransCanada can meet its goals of rates of costs and schedule.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I want to follow up a little bit on this a little bit more. What is the normal, when you do a pipeline, what is the normal time that you do a pre-filing? And are you used to doing it in Canada, and the Office of the Federal Commissioner in Canada has different rules than FERC does? I mean, what's the difference there, and what is the normal procedure for you?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, firstly, TransCanada has 12,000 miles of pipelines in the United States, so we're very familiar with dealing with the United States government and the United States regulatory agencies, including FERC. It has been our experience that for gas pipeline projects, pre-files occur post-open season, not prior to open season. And that is the basis that we developed this schedule. However, we have heard from FERC that they wish that TransCanada would pre-file before the open season. And they've expressed that to us clearly and openly to your body last year. And so we continue to have discussions with them as to is there a structure that can work for them that would meet their requests and that would also meet our needs. But the Norman Gas Pipeline projects in the United States has been to pre-file post open season, which is what our schedule currently says, but we clearly understand that FERC would prefer that we pre-file now.
Just follow up on that. So is this just on the Alaska pipeline, or did they ask that also on the other pipelines that you've done in America?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I cannot speak to other pipelines other than anecdotally that we've done in the United States recently because I've been working on this one. But I am not aware that they have requested that of other recent gas pipelines that we've been completing in the United States, but they've certainly asked that for the Alaska pipeline.
Okay, thank you.
For the benefit of committee members, I've been handed a note that the flight is still in Sitka. They are being scheduled for tonight's flight. So that leaves us up till 3 o'clock here with Mr. Palmer. So I'm going to allow a little bit more of expansion on the issues. We've got a little bit more time to talk on that since we've got just TransCanada here, and we'll make sure that the folks from Denali have adequate time. But just for the benefit of the members, so you, feel free to expand a little bit more on your questioning. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, following up a little bit, can you explain to me, I'm just not familiar with the FERC third-party contractor issue and how that works? I'm not sure what that contractor means, whether it's an oversight contractor or whether they're getting involved in the contractor for environmental or what we mean.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I won't go into detail, but that third-party contractor would generally be FERC's party that would oversee the EIS, Environmental Impact Statement. And so they are, that would be a substantial contract. I would suggest to you that that they would be letting, and that is something that is clearly within their control once there has been a filing or pre-filing by the pipeline company. And all I would suggest to you is that is something that we will be discussing with FERC as we go forward to see if we can resolve their needs and our needs.
Representative Olson.
Oh, thanks, Mr. Chair. This is not a loaded question. I haven't unpacked all my Edgeo boxes yet. I think I have two of them to go. But we're still talking about 4B a day, roughly.
Representative Olson, through the chair, yes. In fact, the pipeline that we have proposed to go through Alberta in the way to the lower 48 is 4.5 BCF a day. The ultimate volume will be determined by what we receive in the open season, either volumes to the lower 48 or volumes to LNG.
And as I recall, it was either DNR or TransCanada that said that 4B a day or the approximate 4B a day could be reached without Point Thompson gas and without Foothill gas. It would have been preferable to have the Point Thompson gas, but it wasn't necessary originally.
Representative Olson, through the chair, I don't think that was my testimony. It must have been the administration's. TransCanada will seek access to all potential gas, but we're clearly not in control of what gas will be available. That's something governments and producers do.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is, in the event that we have a bolt line coming down from the foothills into Cook Inlet, and for one reason or another, the demand exceeds 480 million cubic feet a day. Let's say in round numbers that it's 1B, but it's nothing but foothill gas. Would that have an impact on your gas line? Other than it may trigger some ramifications under the GEA contract.
Representative Olson, through the chair, I won't speak to the ramifications under the GEA contract. I think they're well known to this body. TransCanada believes that the state of Alaska wants to have in-state gas deliveries and also wants to have a large line to export your surplus gas to the marketplace. It's clear that today there is, at Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson, as well as other locations, there's a very large amount of proven gas at on the North Slope. However, there is not sufficient gas for 25 years from those existing fields based on today's information. It may turn out over time that they have more gas than is currently expected, but we do expect to draw on, as I recall, there's something in the order of 20 some years, but not 25. We do expect to draw on exploration. In fact, we think that's one of the goals of AGEA, is to encourage exploration. So we would sure hope that future gas found in the North Slope or in the foothills would be available to the pipeline that exports gas out of Alaska, either to the lower 48 through Canada or to the LNG project, that we'd have a chance to compete for that market, compete for that gas. And I won't speak to the issue you addressed, which is AGEA and the impact of any contribution by the state for anything over 500 million a day pipeline.
Thanks.
Mr. Palmer, can you kind of, you mentioned 4B, is that the minimum amount of gas that you feel it would take to operate it and still be financially successful? I mean, to, just through the economies of scale, 4B is a minimum.
Mr. Chairman, I think what I've testified to is that we expect that customers that want to go through Alberta on the way to Lower 48 would want to see a pipeline that would move at least 3.5 BCF a day, because, just as you described, because of economies of scale, clearly the LNG project would probably be economic for a much lower volume than that. And to date, I think we've looked at a 2 BCF a day potential volume for the project to that location. Not to say that we couldn't construct a 2 BCF a day pipeline through Alaska on the way to Alberta, but the economics would be much less attractive than the $2.76 I showed you.
And just for discussion, say we were Alaska, say we, Alaska, was able to attract some other companies that wanted to do some added value type processing. We could increase our economic opportunities as a state. If, you know, to me, I think it's critical, and I'll share this with the committee members, that, you know, not to put all our eggs in one basket per se. With all the shale gases that are now being found in the lower 48, as you expressed earlier, there's a lot of competition for Alaska's gas. I think it behooves us to try and expand our economic opportunities in the state as much as we can. Can you build a 48-inch line with the anticipation that, you know, we're going to be finding more? And I remember a discussion when Representative Olson came back from Energy Committee last year. He says, you won't believe how much gas, potential gas, not proven reserves, but potential, are in Alaska. And I believe that's the way, somewhere along those lines. There's a lot of gas that probably is in Alaska. It's not.
May I comment?
Sure.
That was including hydrates.
Yeah. But, you know, and the opportunity for that, so that's, I think it's something that we really have to be cognizant of when we're talking about this, you know, and the construction of this pipeline, volumes there, and how that's going to affect gas in Alaska. You know, folks from South Central want to try and make sure we have a gas pipeline to South Central, but the economies of scale, and going back to Mark Meyer, former director of oil and gas discussions that I've had, you know, unless you're getting upwards of a B or 1.5 B a day to South Central, the economies of scale are not there. The tariffs are going to be too high to try and get just a smaller line. Hopefully NSTAR will be able to, or some company, whether it's ANGDO, will be able to try and come up with something there. But that's all going to affect this 48-inch line in the end. Going right back to what Representative Olson pointed out is how much gas do you really need to get down there, and where is it going to go? But, you know, can go on that a little too long. Representative Kawasaki, do you have a question?
No.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll flip to page 12. And on the commercial side, I think I've already been responsive to Representative Kawasaki and other members of the committee as to where we are with potential customers. We have continued those discussions. On the right-hand side, in Q1, Q2, we'll be selecting a contractor for an in-state gas study. We will continue discussions with potential shippers, and we'll continue to develop plans for an open season. And these pictures on the left side, it's just the haul road along the right-of-way. That's all it would look like during construction. That's the haul road where you'd be hauling your pipe along. That's on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, I wanted to show you what a compressor station looks like. So here you have it on the right-hand side. You'd see one of these locations about every 120 miles in Alaska, so six of them in Alaska initially for a 4.5 BCF a day pipeline system. You can see that it is an industrial site. This industrial site is about 1,000 feet by 1,000 feet. And just a couple of statistics for those of you that are interested. The tallest building is the actual compressor station, which is right here. That building is 2 times the height of a two-story house. And I will tell you that's the highest building. That building is 1/6 the height of a 1.5 megawatt wind tower. So those of you that are familiar with wind towers, this is 1/6 that height. And this entire site location of 1,000 feet by 1,000 feet is 1/6 to 1/8 the footprint between 2 1.5 megawatt wind towers. So if you're familiar with wind towers and the spacing between them, this whole site is 1/6 to 1/8 the distance between 2 wind towers. And I will tell you that we have the largest wind power project under construction in Canada today, 740 megawatts. Wow. So some 500 of those wind towers, not all in the same location, I will tell you, that each year we're building about 110 to 120 megawatts of wind power. So you can see that that's 70 to 80 of these wind towers. So you can imagine the stretch of territory that we're covering in particular locations.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Where you have a select contractor for in-state gas study, what is the parameters of in-state I'm not wanting to know what the definition of in-state gas study means.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, that's one of the requirements in AGEA, that we must look at what Alaska's needs are for consumption within Alaska. So we'll be contracting a party that's expert in forecasting gas needs within Alaska. For Alaskan consumption. Slide 13, I'll go through this quickly for you. On the left-hand side, on December the 1st, we took out a lease for our Anchorage office. We have dedicated project office space in Calgary, so that is separate from within TransCanada's tower. In terms of reimbursement under AGEA, we've had initial discussions with the administration regarding the process and mechanics. And as I've described for you, we've initiated the required cost reimbursement agreements with the state and with BLM, that's Federal Bureau of Land Management, for open season field activities, including this winter's geotech program. So we must have those reimbursement agreements in place with both the state and BLM in order for them to allow us to go out and do the winter geotech work. On the right-hand side, in terms of the office, I have been in that office, but we haven't been up and running. And will not be until early February. I'm hopeful that will be next week. We'll have an office manager. We're in the final stages of hiring that person this week and expect them to be in the office by early February, I believe on Monday, but don't quote me on Monday. I think it'll be early next week. And on the reimbursement side, we need to finalize discussions with the state on AGEA reimbursement details, because at the end of March, we had that 25 days in December, but the end of March will be the end of the first quarter, and subsequent to that, we will have to be submitting our invoices to the state for reimbursement. And on the bottom right is, we need to finalize reimbursement agreements with BLM and DNR for access and permits. We hope to do that very shortly, because we need to do that work this winter.
And Mr. Palmer, can you talk about how many Alaskans are employed? When we're looking at page 13, your Anchorage office, your other offices, what you're doing here, how many jobs are we creating here?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that I have the specific number of jobs for each particular contractor. And as you know, some of these jobs were for a particular period of time, but I can probably cite you particular ones as we go through here as to what their contracts were, if you just allow me a second to look through my notes. In fact, I'll address that in an upcoming slide when I speak to specific contractors. You could see that we have not retained a specific employee until this person comes into place next week. The majority of the work to this date has been done by contractors, and in fact will continue to be by contractors. But if you'll allow me to wait until I get to a slide or two from now, I will speak to the actual full-time equivalents for each of those contractors, if that would be helpful to you.
Thank you.
In fact, it happens to be my next slide, aerial photography. You could see that we retained Aerometrics. Subcontractor was Lounsbury and Associated. The aerial photography was 5 FTEs for 7 weeks. The subcontractor was 3 FTEs. FTEs is just full-time equivalents. Okay, in old terminology, that would be men. We don't use that term anymore, full-time equivalents. Okay. Terrain mapping, R&M consultants, I'm told that's 6 FTEs. The geotechnical work for Golder and Associates, that's 6 FTEs for 16 weeks. The subcontractor being Discovery Drilling, that's planned for 7 FTEs for 12 weeks plan. And as you know, that's the to-be work, because that's the geotechnical drilling that we haven't done. We intend to be doing this winter. The environmental planning and permitting, ENSER, ACOM in Anchorage with Claris from Eagle River. I'm told that's 2.5 FTEs. The next one is geothermal modeling and support. I'm told that's 1.5 FTEs. What's the next one? External relations, that is Jade North, that is one FTE.
So I see Representative Wilson's been on the ball and keeping track of those numbers here, so she can tell us how many that is. But I noticed that you're going to have your Anchorage office manager. What are you doing in other parts of the state? What are you doing in Tok and Fairbanks and areas that are going to be affected by this pipeline to make sure that, again, those smaller companies who maybe can't come down to Anchorage, what are you doing to make sure that they're in the game here?
And, Mr. Chairman, at this stage, we carefully considered the appropriate location for the project office in Alaska, whether it would be Anchorage or Fairbanks. We examined both. We looked at the opportunities and benefits and of both locations. We decided that at this phase of the project, early in the project, Anchorage was the more appropriate location. But we also have indicated that as we move forward and move to things like construction, it's very likely we will have other offices, particularly in Fairbanks, right on the route, centrally located. But at this stage, when you look at the type of work that we have underway, it was our assessment that Anchorage was the more appropriate location. Will we look at other locations as well? Yes, we will do so as we go forward appropriately to assess the benefits to Alaska, but always keeping in mind the project costs and the project schedule. That is front of mind for us in everything we do.
Yeah, project cost, and you know, you said that you want to make sure that you keep those project costs and schedule in mind, but I'm sure that our Fairbanks legislators are going to try and make sure that those folks are represented there too, so I'm sure they'll stay on top of it for us, Representative Kawasaki and Gutenberg, any on this committee.
And Mr. Chairman, we're very cognizant of that, and we were very focused on what type of work will be proceeding at this stage during the open season relative to what will be occurring as we move forward into more active right-of-way work, which will be post-open season.
Thank you.
We've also had alignment meetings with a number of players, Alyeska, ANGDA, NSTAR, Department of Transport. I've just identified for you some of the things we've been involved with, Department of Labor, and Alaska Natives and socioeconomic issues. I won't take you through this, but we have started to be active on this front. In fact, we have representatives meeting with the North Slope Borough in Barrow later this week. So we're out and active, involved in the departments and other agencies that we will need to engage with, as well as corporations that may be involved in the project.
Could you expand a little bit more? You said you've had alignment meetings with Alyeska and ANGDA and NSTAR. Could you give us an idea of, you don't have to tell us what you're, what's going on in those discussions? I mean, we're all pretty curious as to, you know, bullet lines and what they're doing. What relationship does that have to do with a 48-inch line that TransCanada is building?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The discussions with Alyeska, of course, have to do with some of the things that Representative Gutenberg asked me about earlier, which is how would we be accessing their right-of-way? Okay, they clearly have a right-of-way for their existing pipeline, and how would we be interfacing with them? So that was the extent of those discussions, and they're ongoing. We've had discussions with ANGDA and NSTAR with regards to the work that they are doing for their proposed in-state pipe relative to the work that we will need to do for the larger pipe. So are there ways for us to keep each other well informed of what we're doing? TransCanada, of course, as indicated, we're not going to be involved in the in-state gas line, and I think both of these parties have indicated they're not going to be involved in the larger line for export. However, it is important, we feel, to keep each other informed as to how we're progressing the project so that they understand what work we have upcoming and we understand what they have upcoming. That's the nature of the discussions we've had with them, not how they would prosecute their projects or how we would prosecute our project, but simply informational, and we'll continue to do that so that they understand what work we may have along the right-of-way in an upcoming period of quarters, and they would do the same with us.
Will you be, I see you talk about a little bit, Department of Labor, Workforce Development. Is TransCanada Alaska Incorporated, are you going to be putting money into workforce development opportunities, and how is your project going to bring Alaskans into the training program?
Mr. Chairman, TransCanada has been involved with that agency. We have not committed at this point to invest training dollars. We know that the state of Alaska has done so. TransCanada is participating in the Strategic Planning, Steering, and Implementation Committee. We're attending a number of seminars and other sessions they've had, but training of individuals for this project is something that normally governments would undertake, not proponents.
Certainly nice to have a partnership between industry and the government at the same time, though, on these projects.
Mr. Chairman, I would agree with you, and you'll see that we continue to meet our obligations, and clearly what we intend to do to have Alaskans engaged on this project. We believe that the training that is involved, the government of Alaska has indicated that they will make some contributions. I think there's also been indications over time as to what the government of the United States will do. And I described to you that the construction phase on this project is 2 years. So those folks that would be working on this project will need skills that are transferable, that cannot just be looking for a 2-year or 3-year employment, but can be looking for long-term employment in Alaska, not just on the pipeline, but in other industries in Alaska on an ongoing basis. I've also described for you openly the number of operational jobs on the pipeline once it's in service. They're relatively modest. That's what an efficient pipeline company will do. The operations roles on this project, once complete, is probably in the order of 50 to 75 people. So when you consider several thousand folks needed for the construction, and then 50 to 75 once completed, the majority of those folks will need to be redeployed into other industries, probably oil and gas, hopefully E&P operations, exploration and production, to be able to look for new gas. So those skills need to be transferable, and their training needs to be such that they can apply those skills across the board, not just on a 2-year construction program on a project like a pipeline.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All right. I know, talking to ANGA, they have been looking at trying to do a schedule so that a spur line would be constructed before your construction would start, so that there could be not competition for the same people, but that there would be a readily available workforce after their construction is done. Is there any kind of coordination, or is there any kind of a process by which those people that have been involved in building the other pipeline in Alaska will be able to move from that project on to this project?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, at the present time there is no formal process, but clearly those folks will be well qualified if they've been constructing the other to be available to contractors as well as directly to TransCanada. If they have been employed a year or two earlier, they will have fresh skills and high quality skills and direct experience in the right of way. I think they'll be very attractive employees for other contractors or TransCanada. That's one of the reasons why we are talking to ANGDA and NSTAR, is to understand their plans and our plans and to be able to better coordinate as we go forward. Those things will evolve as we move from open season to permitting to construction.
Thank you.
Representative Olson and Gutenberg.
Oh, thanks, Mr. Chair. In July, I asked you a question about the status of the First Nations. And again, without the either the benefit or the curse of having my notes in front of me, as I recall, your answer was virtually all of them are on board with the exception of one or two. And I wondered if you can give us a update on the First Nations.
Representative Olson, through the chair, TransCanada holds a valid right-of-way through the entire Yukon for this project. Have held it for 25 years, made right-of-way payments for this project for 25 years. No other party has that. We've had discussions with those First Nations for up to 30 years. Within Yukon, Six of eight of the right-of-way First Nations have settled land claims. In every case for those six, our right-of-way is specifically noticed and recognized in their land, in their final land claim. There are two remaining parties that have not settled their land claim. However, the umbrella final agreement established between the Government of Canada, the Government of Yukon, and all Yukon First Nations in 1993, 10 years after our right-of-way was established, specifically highlights our right-of-way, specifically identifies it, and specifically says that that will be recognized in every First Nation land claim when they're completed. So although we have no control as to when those final two First Nations will complete their land claim negotiations with the Government of Canada, we're a commercial party, we're not involved with that, we hold a right-of-way through the entire Yukon for the project and can proceed under that. In BC, you're in, we do not have a right-of-way, we have what's called a map reserve, line on a map, and but you're in traditional pipelining territory where there are thousands of miles of pipe in the ground today, moving gas. And there's a known process, an under, well-understood process, and we're confident we can achieve that as well. So I don't want to speak for First Nations as to where they are in terms of support or otherwise for the project, but TransCanada will be engaging with those people very soon in this year to continue to work with them to seek their support for the project.
So you're optimistic?
I remain optimistic, Representative Olson through the chair, but I don't want to speak for third parties as to how they will react as we put something in front of them.
Representative Gutenberg, then
you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I find myself in a position that I wish 40 years ago, 50 years ago, people sitting in these chairs would have been more active. Because it's always been my contention and my belief that that during the Alyeska pipeline construction and infrastructure that happened on the North Slope, people of the state of Alaska really got the short end of the stick. I don't know why. I look at your. I'm not going to ask you to move to Tok like some others have, but I look at the list of your subcontractors, and predominantly they're from south central, and that's fine. They're all going to have field offices along the route someplace. I'm not sure. I can't imagine you not having field offices.
Representative Gutenberg, could you speak a little closer to your microphone or talk louder?
I can't imagine you not wanting to have headquarters, at least field headquarters. Somewhere along the route, but I'm also concerned. Your FTEs that you talked about. One here, two here, three here. That's fine. At some point down the road, you should tell them that when you come to down to Juneau, that people are going to ask you who qualified for a permanent fund last year and the year before. That you have hiring halls or hiring facilities in the state. That we from this point, and I was delighted to approve the contract, but we're certainly going to be looking over your shoulder and who gets these opportunities. I mean, the exportable skills. I can tell you that my generation of pipeline workers didn't have one or two skills, but we probably had four or five, or probably six, because the way construction work. In Alaska, certainly pipeline work and certainly oil field work is you absolutely know that one year to the next you don't know what field or what skill you're going to have to be skilled in and trained in. Many times I was told and I saw it that Alaskans are unqualified, and the people that were brought up from various places, whether it was Tulsa or East Coast or West Coast or somewhere in the South, had no skills at all. They just happened to know somebody. And that's part of the history in the boom and bust cycle that I think it's what I try and do down here is try to level that off. And certainly in a boom cycle like this, that we were looking at it if you reach an open season and begin construction. But I think it's you know, when you go forward from this point on, that you're going to be asked these questions. And I think whether I'm here or somebody else is here, I hope that we have good answers to those questions.
And Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, I appreciate your comments. You understand that we are 7 weeks mm-hmm. into an AGEA license at this point.
None too soon to ask them.
I've tried to be fulsome mm-hmm. in who has been contracted to this project to date. I've tried to be fulsome with my description as to how many full-time equivalents we've had. I'm not here in front of you today to be able to describe to you what qualifications those individuals have for those contractors. But I've heard your question. I understand where you're coming from on an ongoing basis. And as we ramp up the work, as we go forward, and that's exactly what happens in projects, we'll do our utmost to be responsive to those specific questions.
Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to the project schedule on page 6, we can see that the construction timeline is basically a two-year period, 2016-2018. Certainly there'll be work that leads up to that point, but back to the AGEA bill itself and the project labor agreement, when do the provisions of that part of the bill really start kicking in and being utilized along this project schedule timeline?
Representative Edgman, through the chair, I'm going to have to go from memory because I don't specifically recall that. But as I recall, I think we need to do that before we get to project sanction. But I'm not positive that that's the case.
Okay. So maybe we can get a clarification on that, Mr. Chairman, at some other point.
Thank you, Representative Edgman. I think it would be interesting, too, to bring the, and I'm sure my co-chair will agree, to bring the administration in and we can kind of query them on some of those issues there, the project labor agreement, how that's going to work in association with whether it's TransCanada or Denali, or if it may be eventually a combination of both or all of the above. So it'll be interesting.
Mr. Chairman, I'll take you to the final slide. The AGEA bill has been approved and the license was issued last month. I hope I've shown you that we have significant work underway. I won't take you through that in detail. We have commenced commercial and regulatory engagement. We've got Alaska contractors retained. The office is in place. We continue to target to conclude the open season 8 months from now, and we will focus on cost, schedule, and attracting customers. And with that, I thank you for your attention today, and I'm pleased to take any concluding questions if you have them.
Representative Edgman, and then Kawasaki.
Yes, a few slides ago, Mr. Palmer, you mentioned 740 megawatts of power, the largest facility of its nature in Canada, but any plans at this point of doing something similar on the Alaska side? And not to that scale, mind you, but...
Representative Edgman, through the chair, I can't speak for the power generation part of TransCanada. I mean, I can tell you that they look across North America for opportunities to invest TransCanada's shareholders' money in power projects. And I will tell you that they are involved, we are involved in everything from natural gas generation through nuclear, through coal, through hydro, through wind. I'm not sure if I've missed a fuel source as we walk through that. What made the project in Quebec, the 740 megawatt project, attractive to TransCanada was a 20-year power purchase contract from Hydro-Quebec. And that allowed TransCanada to focus on things that we think we're good at, which is cost and schedule. We knew we had a buyer for the power. We knew the price for the power. And so if we can deliver the project on cost, on budget, and on schedule, we think we can make good profits. I'm not familiar enough with the Alaska environment on the power side to be able to comment on that.
So, Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up. There's basically what you're telling me then is that it's really not in the plans at this point, but, you know, if it makes the project more economical, that who knows, maybe it might be part of the plans down the road?
Representative Edgemond, through the chair, I'm sorry, I'm not sure that I had understood your earlier question. If you were, if the question related to the gas pipeline and an electric component of that, I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. Let me just respond to that. At present, I think we plan that the compressor stations would be fueled with natural gas. However, we have compressor stations across North America. Some of them are fueled with natural gas. Some of them are electric fired. So if there is an economical source of electricity, that's one alternative, is to use electrical power to fire those compressors. On the flip side, we also have circumstances where we generate electricity from those compressor stations fueled with natural gas. To make that economic, you have to be close to a user, or you have to have access to economical transmission. I'm telling you that at this stage of development of the project, we haven't gone far enough to know whether or not that's in place, but will those be things that we look at? Clearly they will be.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, is that responsive to your question? I misunderstood you earlier.
Mr. Palmer, I think you're going to get a chance to talk to our co-chairs on energy on that a little bit further by that question. Representative Kawasaki, Seaton, and Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Palmer, you were talking about employment across Alaska and some of the Alaskan contractors, and you mentioned that there's a dedicated office open in Calgary. Can you tell me just what the employment side is on the Canada portion of the line? I mean, you've ramped up, obviously, employment within your organization specifically dedicated to the TC Alaska line. I'm just curious what the employment looks like on the Canadian side.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, I have some information on that as well. I didn't put it on the slides for this audience, but let me just go through it. We have some environmental planning and permitting work. That's 2.5 FTEs, and unfortunately the other numbers that I have here do not have FTEs. So I was presenting to an Alaska audience. I apologize, I don't have that, but there are dedicated TransCanada employees working on this project now. We have a structure within TransCanada for any project where we have certain dedicated people, and then we have part-time people that work on this as they work on multiple projects. And in terms of dedicated people today, I would suggest to you there's probably 10 or 15 people that are dedicated to the project today. And there are other people that we call on from across the corporation to provide their skills as necessary as we address the issues that go forward. And that's the way we integrate a project, not just the Alaska project, but the Keystone Oil project and all the other projects we have going. That provides low-cost service to our projects and efficient and high-level skills.
And Mr. Palmer, if you would, just kind of maybe you could give us an idea to the committee's aides and or to the chairs, and we'll get it to the rest of the committee on employment opportunities for Alaskans and Canada side. But and then we'll that way I'll kind of answer those questions. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. On slide 6, you have the timeline of the project. You know, in AGIA we committed to a reimbursement, but I'm curious as to whether an estimated timeline for amounts of reimbursement there. I know that we appropriated part of that fiscal amount last year, and I'm just wondering if there's an estimation of in the next fiscal year what that reimbursement request could be under the timeline that you've set out here.
Representative Seaton, through the chair. TransCanada proposed in our AGIA application that we believe we will expend $84 million to the conclusion of our open season. So that would be to July 2010. And My understanding is last year you appropriated $30 million, and I believe that there is a budget request for $20 million in this year's budget. I do not have an update to our $84 million. That's still TransCanada's estimate. I think we also estimated that through a FERC certificate that our estimate was $611 million, as I recall. That included the 84. I do not have any updates to that, but clearly as we go forward in time, we will update. But at the moment, TransCanada still stands by those numbers, and as we let contracts and do work, we will have improved numbers, either up or down from that, but I don't have them as I sit in front of you today, 7 weeks after the issuance of the license.
Thank you.
Representative Bowles.
Oh, thanks, Mr. Chair. The next question I'm going to be asking of Denali, and had they been here today, I would have had a chance to, but can you foresee any scenario that would prevent TransCanada from participating in an open season next year?
Representative Olson, through the chair, at the present time, TransCanada believes this schedule is achievable. We are working very hard to achieve this schedule. But I will never say never. I've described for you that we received the license 4 months after we expected to. We did some preliminary work at our own cost. However, we did lose some period of that 4 months. We are doing our utmost to maintain the schedule. But I'm not going to represent in front of you today that there's a zero possibility that I slip from July 31st, 2010, after getting a license 4 months and 4 days after I had hoped to.
Again, without the benefit or the curse of my notes, as I recall in July, you had indicated at that point in time that by not getting the contract immediately, it was probably not going to have any impact. And again, if anybody on the committee has a different recollection, please jump in. But
Representative Olson's through the chair, and my recollection was at that time we didn't know the final date for the schedule. And I would, if I did say it's probably not going to have an impact, I would continue to say it's probably not going to have an impact. That's quite different than saying I can't foresee any scenario. And so I would absolutely say today that it's probably not going to have an impact.
Thanks.
Representative Seaton, doing okay? Any other questions? Representative Gutenberg.
Just a quick observation. It was just last summer when we were working on this. The world has been upside down, and it was just in early December when they signed the contract. So we're asking you why you're not ordering pipe and building things, but just to keep things in perspective.
Thank you. I think it's probably a good practice, too, and I'll talk to my co-chair about this, since Labor and Commerce typically will be following resources on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, which starts at 3 o'clock, and since we have the chair and the vice chair sitting on this committee, we'll probably try and make it a point to get out of here at least by 5 minutes to three to allow us to get up and be ready, because I know he likes to start on time. I would like to welcome our newest member of the legislature, Representative Tuck. I would ask him to try and get as many meetings as you can with Mr. Palmer and the rest of the committee members to get up to date as much as you can. This is a big issue. This is a huge issue in Alaska. I know a lot of the committee members, I'm looking around here, have been on this at least 4 years, if not 2 years, on these issues. I would also like to note that we have a new addition in the resources room, a beautiful Kenai River King salmon, around the 83-pound range. Just another representative example of what Alaska has to offer in our resources. Any other final comments from committee members? Representative Olson?
That fish is from my district.
Doesn't vote.
We're trying to grow some out of Willow Creek that get there, but we just haven't got there yet.
Stop.
Okay, maybe something for the Representative Seaton and the Fisheries Committee to look at. Okay, thank you. And with that, I will say the time is 3:55, and we are adjourned.